Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sherrod Cutton.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. In its 2001 annual report, Bank Negara revealed that while Malaysia's household debt to GDP ratio has improved to 89%, compared to a record of 93% just a year ago, we still have one of the highest ratios in the region. Now, this is further exacerbated by the fact that most Malaysian households have low savings buffers. What does this all reveal about the financial resilience of Malaysian households? Let's speak now to Nirmala Subramaniam. She's the head of household financial education at the Credit Counselling and Debt Management Agency, which is more commonly known by its Malay acronym for Agency Counselling dan Pengurusan Kredit, AKPK. AKPK is an agency under Bank Negara, which aims to help individuals with the responsible use of credit. Nirmala, I'm going to take a look at the breakdown of household debt. And what strikes me is that the mortgage component, the housing loan component, makes up about 60% of household debt. What does that reveal to you or tell you about the indebtedness and the financial fragility of Malaysian households?
Thanks, Melissa. Thank you for having me on the show. And like mentioned, 60% of the household debts actually were from the mortgage loan. And they also mentioned that this growth was probably driven by the home ownership campaign that was going on previously, you know, till the end of December last year. It was a heavy home ownership campaign where a lot of incentives were given out to the consumers in terms of owning their own house, purchasing their own house with low down payments, even zero down payments and everything. So that could have played a part in terms of, you know, raising up the mortgage the side of the household debt. But overall, when we look at this, yes, definitely there is an increase if we were to compare to pre-pandemic and pre-COVID period, right? But it also relates to the consumption in terms of like this. It clearly shows there was one part of it is the home ownership campaign, but it also comes back to the vulnerability of Malaysians looking back in terms of how ready and how resilient are we when it comes to managing our debt and managing our finances. Because there were numerous studies done prior to this, and research done even by AKPK. We have done our FBES, our AKPK financial behavior study within the working adults. And it did show that 3 out of 10 Malaysian working adults actually need to borrow to buy essential goods. You know, so they actually borrow to buy essential goods, 3 out of 10 Malaysians. And through the FCI survey, the Financial Capability and Inclusion Demand Side Survey, our FBES, EPF statistics, it also shows that 52% of Malaysians have difficulty to raise 1,000 when it comes to emergency. So I guess if we have this problem and when there is an emergency, obviously the next option is we go for debts, right? If we do not have the savings, right? Mm-hmm. And it also showed that through the statistics that only 24% of Malaysians are able to sustain a living expenses for at least 3 months if they lose their main source of income. So in this sense, we can kind of say that when it comes to financial shocks, when it comes to sudden changes, I guess we are still very vulnerable, and we do not have we still have a lot to look into in terms of building savings, in terms of building our financial capability here.
Right, Nirmala, since you're in the business of counseling people, as it were, could you help us understand if you make a distinction between good debt and bad debt? I mean, in your description just now, it sounds like, a housing loan might be good because it's an investment in an asset. Correct me if I'm wrong. Whereas if you're borrowing money to pay for essential goods like, food on the table, that signals maybe a household in distress. How do you explain it to people?
Yeah. Agreed. Good debts and bad debts. Buying a house is obviously considered a good debt because it increases in value, you know, it appreciates in value. So it is considered a good debt. But when they are looking, that's why I raised the statistics of buying for essential goods, you know, catering your lifestyle, when you're taking up debts to cater your lifestyle, that is something that we really want to avoid. We really want to say that if you are taking up a debt for productive purpose, like buying a property, buying an asset that would appreciate in value, or you are taking up to generate an income, that means you are starting this debt because you want to generate more income, maybe start a business and things like that. So yes, that will be considered as a productive debt. But if you are looking at a debt where to cater your lifestyle or your life needs, which is not going to help you in any way in terms of increasing an income or generating a revenue, because, for example, people take debts to get married, people take debts to go for holiday, people take debts, you know, even we consider to renovate your property. See, there's a difference here. I buy a property and I renovate a property, taking up a loan makes a difference, because renovating is not appreciating the value. It's not going to add up that much. See, so there is a difference to this. So this is where when a person wants to take up a debt, we would always encourage them to look at 3 P's. One is the purpose, like you mentioned, whether am I taking this debt for a productive purpose or a non-productive? What is the reason, the purpose of it? The second is my payment affordability. What can I really afford? So this is where also we need to know what is offered to her, offered to us, may not be what is affordable to us. You know, what the financial institutions or the, you know, they are offering to us may not be what we really can afford. So the payment affordability, we need to understand that what we can really afford in terms of taking up a loan. So that's the second P that we want to look at. And the third P that we also want to look at is at the payment records. This is very important because, you know, we are all our loans, all our borrowings have a record. And when we don't maintain a good record, that means if we don't took up a loan and we don't maintain the payment, we are not a good paymaster, that jeopardizes the whole thing, you know. So we have to manage these three things well. We understand this. That means I would always say, like, I look at myself at the mirror first before I would want to go out, right? So I would want to look at myself, see what is the purpose, what is my affordability, how are my standings like at the moment before I would want to go for another loan.
Right. Well, if I may just look at the savings component, I think that's quite interesting because what you mentioned in terms of financial behavior was that some households struggle to perhaps raise 1,000 ringgit in cash, may not have more than 3 months of living expenses for savings. How does the indebtedness of households perhaps impact saving behavior or the ability to save?
Yes, obviously when we talk about saving, the first thing that comes to our mind is I don't have enough to sustain, then how would I look at savings, right? Mm-hmm. I totally agree. But I guess when we talk about savings, we are also always on the mindset that it has to be something big. You know, monthly I have to allocate a few hundred and that's what I call savings, you know. We have done a few programs with the small industries, like we have done programs with the micro entrepreneurs, enterprises like the kakak who sell nasi lemak or who sell cendol by the roadside. We have done programs with them, and what we gather is like obviously they say it's so hard to sustain, how do I save, you know? So we go by methods of like try saving small. Even a ringgit a day is considered savings, and that could actually help. So when we have a example of a lady who actually saved up every 20 ringgit that she gets, she saved up, and over a period it comes to up an amount. So that amount was actually very helpful to her during the pandemic when the crisis hit, when she couldn't open up her stall, when she couldn't set. So it's about starting small but doing it consistently, and that consistent would actually help in a way that in short terms of emergencies or things like that, I could actually use up these funds to diversify my current source of income, because so, yeah. I think something that we learn.
So Nirmala, I'm gathering from our discussion that, you know, you're focused on the individual, their personal responsibility, rather than the question of whether the government should step in, provide a universal basic income for people, especially the working class of Malaysia, and all these other kind of conversations that are being held globally about, you know, creating resilience among populations. But, so can I ask you, on the question of personal responsibility, are there habits, bad habits that Malaysians have, that you have noticed, that really need to be addressed and changed?
I mean, from our observation, from the clients who come to us, yes, we have observed that. I'm not going to say all, I'm not going to generalize and say, oh, everybody is doing this. No, but there are very, very, very circumstances, cases like, you know, sickness, loss of job. This is not none of their fault, no fault of theirs. You know, things happen around that, and issues happen. But generally, what we see is a lot of us live for the moment. You know, like I don't think too much for the savings for the future, and especially if what we have noticed among our clients is like when it comes to like this, when there is an emergency, I just don't have that cash, because I live for the moment that, okay, whatever I have now is used for now, it's done for now. And it's not thought that, oh, such thing, especially those who are employed, we are very comfortable to say that, you know, I'm employed, I'm getting a monthly salary, so I do not foresee any issue to this. Because I've seen clients who have sudden illness or family member falling ill and things like that, but because they were so comfortable of like, okay, I'm receiving a monthly income, this is so enough for me, more than enough for the family. But when there is a shock of this that needs more than what we have, that's when they're in trouble. So when they have it, they're not thinking how to manage it well. So when I have it, I'm like just comfortable with what I have, but when I don't. And the other thing that I see is, of course, in terms of taking debts. Okay, for example, that if I were to take a debt, I look at what is offered to me. This is something we all have had gone through, I think. We assume that the financier knows us better. We assume that what they offer us is the best rate. We do not assess ourselves. We do not know how to assess ourselves.
We kind of outsource that responsibility to someone else.
Responsibility. Okay. So when I want to buy a car, I go to the bank. I say, look, I want to buy the car. This is the amount. And he says, for your salary, I think you can pick up to this amount. Why take this car? Why don't go to that car? So we think that they know us better and they're giving us the best advice. You see,
right.
That's the gap that we have there as well.
Okay, Nirmala, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Appreciate you sharing those insights. Nirmala Subramaniam from the Credit Counseling and Debt Management Agency, AKPK. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We will be back with more on this topic. Stay tuned. Staying with Shrad and I on Consider This, let's take a closer look at the relationship between the cost of housing and household indebtedness. This comes as earlier this year, Prime Minister Ismail Sabri Yaakob called for Bank Negara to review its financing model to facilitate house ownership for the B40 and M40 income groups. Now, what implications might this have on Malaysia's household debt ratio? Let's speak now to Dr. Carmelo Felito. He is the CEO of the think tank Center for Market Education. Carmelo, I'm just wondering what you see as the kind of cause, the underlying cause for the elevated levels of household indebtedness in Malaysia, and perhaps the relationship between that and cost of housing in Malaysia.
Yeah, the two things are connected, in fact, and
I have been telling for a few years now that you can't make a policy that somehow push for homeownership without creating concern of indebtedness of the families in Malaysia. And given the numbers that that we have now in terms of homeownership and household debt over the GDP, I think that the household debt is a much more important issue to be addressed. And this talk about the development model that Malaysia has, the components of the GDP. In example, if you look at the GDP of 2021, was mainly pushed by government spending and by private consumption, while investment remain a little bit behind or flat. So the two things are definitely related, and in terms of policy, you know, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs, so it's a matter of a choice to decide where to go. But I think that when we discuss home affordability, we are not putting into the picture the transactions that happen in the secondary market. So we always refer to the primary market, new projects, the new launch, the overhang. But by doing that, we ignore or we don't consider that almost 80% of the transactions happen in the secondary market. So I believe, and unfortunately there is not availability of data like for the new launches, I believe that people in the M40 and the B40 are mainly recurring to the secondary market when they have to buy a house, and they don't look at new launches. And it also makes sense. I think that we can't really believe in a model in which every person that leave the house of mother and father buy a house that is newly launched. So we will keep on needing new launches for the new families that are formed. And what is going to happen to the old houses? It's going to be destroyed. So I believe that the conversation is a bit biased by not keeping into account that actually most of the transactions happen in the secondary market, and means that there the level of affordability is something different.
Oh, so, okay, let's talk about that difference, Carmelo. You're saying that actually the picture that we have is not complete, that's slightly distorted. If you had that, and you're saying there is a lack of data, but if you would speculate then, what would it look like? I mean, is there more affordability in the secondary market? What would change in terms of our concerns about housing affordability?
Yeah, definitely the level of affordability is higher for what we can guess. And the fact that 80%, almost 80% of the real estate transactions happen in the secondary market is telling that the people are looking at that market. They are not really looking at new launches. And probably new launches are a matter of investment for big investors or for real estate speculators, for people that are looking at a different strategy, like a reserve of value, rather than the place where they are going to live.
Right, okay. And if so, how do we then address that? Because what you're trying to say, I think, is there is such a mismatch between what's coming out to the market, between what people want. How then do we kind of close that mismatch? Is that an issue for free market principles, or is there a role for government in this?
Well, obviously there is a choice. So developers are making the choice to produce in the primary market that kind of houses. And I hope that they do so by thinking that they are going to make a profit out of it. While the people that really look at a place where to stay, they are looking at a different kind of market. So probably it's misleading also discussing about the mismatch, because what the developers are launching in the market as a new launches is something targeting a different market, not necessarily the normal people, which instead are recurring to the secondary market. So and probably with the evolution of the property market in Malaysia, I mean, I think that we have to consider that we are not anymore in the period in which you buy a house, a new launch, cheap, and you can double the value of that property, let's say, in 10 years. That times are gone. So we are looking at more mature market in which probably the returns are not that high. And probably in this kind of market, the role of rental and the role of secondary market will be even more and more important. And somehow, probably in the future, the developers will have to make their choices on what to launch and what to take care in the market.
Camillo, you know, the way the governments discuss and way, you know, the issue of housing affordability is discussed in the mass media, for instance, underlying it is the presumption that there's a concern that people don't actually own their homes. The government is pushing this primarily out of social concerns and as a matter of social policy, that home ownership is a good thing. And there are, of course, middle-class aspirations, at least in Malaysia, that still hold to home ownership as a good thing. But we know that globally this is changing in many parts of the world. People rent rather than buy and so on and so forth. Where do you see this push for home ownership? And do you agree that home ownership is actually a good thing for individuals?
Well, I think that it depends on the individual preferences. Just to make you an example, if I had a mortgage on a house when I got a job offer to come in Malaysia 10 and a half years ago, most probably I wouldn't get that job and would remain in Italy because I had to take care of my home loan. So I think that it is not right or wrong to aspire to have a house. It's a matter of preference. But we are also living a moment of changing preferences. Look at the youth. Probably they want to be more free to explore job opportunities abroad. And obviously this doesn't go together with a long-term financial commitment. So the two things don't go together. But to come back to the role of government, as I mentioned earlier, I think that is important to realize that every push toward homeownership is also making more fragile the financial situation of the households. So it's a matter of choice. What do we want to preserve? We want really to push by increasing the debt level of the people and therefore putting the people more at risk in the case of cyclical fluctuations, or we want to address instead debt, because you can't address both, unfortunately. It's a matter of trade-offs. You have to choose which one you want to address. And in my opinion, with an home ownership in Malaysia that is close to 70% and household debt over GDP that is close to 90%, the real emergency to be addressed is household debt.
And can I follow up on that? What would you like to see, how would you like to see household debt addressed?
Well, obviously, there are no easy solution and not short-term solution. I think that we need to move in two directions. One is educational, so also accompanying the people with initiatives in terms of financial literacy to try to explain that they have to expose themselves for what they can, make the step proportionate to your possibilities. And on the other side, I think that the most important thing to be done in this moment is to change our growth model, which is too oriented on consumption, government and household consumption, private consumption, but private investment remains stagnant. If we are able to rebuild an investment structure, both domestic and foreign investment, then we can create opportunities for people to move up. In fact, I think that the main issue for me is never poverty or home ownership, but is social mobility. So you are born in a condition, it's not your fault, but are you living in a country that gives you the chance to improve that condition if you work hard, if you deserve, and et cetera, et cetera. So that is where we have to work, social mobility.
All right. Thank you so much, Camillo, for speaking with us today. That was our conversation with Dr. Camillo Felito from the Think Tech Center for Market Education. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching.
And good night.